This week on The Take, we're marking 1 year since a pair of devastating earthquakes hit Turkey and Syria with a new digital interactive. Listen and watch stories of survival, recovery, and coping with the grief at aljazeera.com/earthquakes. Again, that's aljazeera.com/earthquakes.
Finally, a ceasefire resolution passes at the United Nations. But what difference does it make when Israel will not honor it and the U.S. calls it non-binding? In Gaza, the horrors of ethnic cleansing are compounded by Israeli surveillance technology. And Narendra Modi's re-election campaign in India, powered by an army of foot soldiers on the ground and a messaging blitz on WhatsApp. This past week's United Nations Security Council resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza, the first to do so, is significant, although not for the reasons its authors may have intended. The passage of the resolution at the highest body of the UN, with the US declining to use its veto, could mark a pivotal moment in Israel's increasing international isolation. For its Western backers, the fact that Israel, through its continued bombardment and starvation of Palestinians, is defying that resolution, makes their role that much harder to defend. In the Israeli media, the opposition to the UN vote is almost unanimous. More striking is the lack of interest from American news outlets. The implications this story raises are a little uncomfortable for them as well. They hit close to home. Because a fallacy has been exposed, the one about the U.S.-led international rules-based order, in which the rules are selectively applied.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution please raise their hand?
It was the ultimate mixed message sent from Washington to Tel Aviv that upon examination amounts to some cynical politics.
Abstention.
For at least 32,000 Palestinians in Gaza, including those who have been starved to death in front of our eyes, the ceasefire resolution that passed at the United Nations Security Council this past week comes too late. For those still getting killed by Israel's bombing of Rafah, the patients and medical staff at Al-Shifa Hospital still getting shot by Israeli soldiers, it has had no discernible effect. After vetoing three previous ceasefire resolutions, the American government finally allowed this one, which would last just 2 weeks, to carry. But the U.S.'s ambassador to the UN then argued, incorrectly according to legal experts, that unlike every other resolution the Security Council has ever passed, this one was in a category of its own, that it was somehow non-binding.
We fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution.
And I hope she was being merely rhetorical, because she certainly can't be speaking from a legal perspective. All UN Security Council resolutions are binding. The UN Charter makes that perfectly clear. It then takes another resolution to determine what actions will be taken if the parties defy it, as Israel has said it's going to do. But whether or not it's enforced, it's certainly binding as a matter of law.
If the Americans are arguing that this is a non-binding resolution, they are winking at Netanyahu by saying, you really don't have to implement it. The message to the Israelis is that you can carry on with the war until you achieve whatever objectives you have in mind.
I don't think Benjamin Netanyahu cares much about the international community, the United Nations Security Council, the UN. They've made it clear within minutes of the resolution passing that the Israelis have no intention of abiding by it. And indeed, less than 24 hours after the passage of that resolution, about 17 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli bombardment with scores of others injured. So the message is clear. Israel has no intention of abiding by Resolution 2728's call on the parties to cease fire.
The Netanyahu government put on a display of outrage over the Biden administration's refusal to veto the resolution by initially canceling a visit by an Israeli delegation to Washington before quietly rescheduling it. it could have recalled its defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who was already in D.C. shoring up more American arms shipments to Israel. It did not. Other political figures, like Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, dismissed the UN as anti-Semitic. This in a country that owes its very existence to the United Nations. On the Israeli airwaves, the calls for Palestinian blood keep coming. And partisan domestic politics are also a big part of the mix.
Cast our mind back pre-October 7th, where you have a deeply polarized society. The anti-Bibi camp, the demonstrations every week, and the pro-Bibi camp. The reaction splits along those lines. What you will see from journalists in the anti-Bibi camp is, aha, here we have Bibi destroying the reputation of Israel.
אנחנו מסתכסכים עם בעלת הברית הזאת באמצע המלחמה. אפשר לריב עם ארצות הברית, מותר לריב עם ארצות הברית, על הקשקוש הזה, זה פשוט בלתי מתקבל על הדעת.
For the other side, this is dangerous UN, America losing its way.
המדינה שמובילה את העולם החופשי חברה היום לגרועות שבמדינות, לגרועים שברודנים, לרצחניים שברודנים נגד מדינת ישראל. זה מה...
Who's the guy who can stand up to this? You guessed it. Benjamin Netanyahu.
What stands out in the American media coverage of this story is the noticeable lack of it. For the U.S. to fail to side with Israel at the UN is almost unheard of and is certainly newsworthy. Couple that with the legal side of the story, the U.S. arguing that a Security Council resolution is somehow not binding. One would expect journalists to test that position, pick it apart. We're not seeing that. Neither are American news consumers. And, like Israel, domestic politics in the U.S. are having an impact.
There has been a great deal of lack of interest in American media, especially the so-called liberal media in the United States, regarding the resolution. The Biden administration is trying to avoid the fallout of the abstention, and therefore, media that are supportive of the Democratic Party made sure that they really did not dedicate so much time and coverage so that they would minimize any possible repercussions that would be exploited by their opponents in the Republican Party, especially a few months before the presidential elections.
The lack of coverage, it's consistent with the manner in which the question of Palestine has been represented in the West, in mainstream media, and that has basically been through the prism of an Israeli lens.
You're not Hamas. Israel is a democracy, and as a Jewish state, supports and believes in every life mattering. And so,
and this is matched in Canadian and United Kingdom and other Western states' foreign policies. It's harder for the Western mainstream media to continue with their biased coverage, in large part because you have the proliferation of social media from the Gazan street to the rest of the world.
And because of the extent to which mainstream media in particular is very sensitive about being criticized from Israel and its right-wing supporters in particular, it's been shy to highlight actions that are deemed to be critical of Israel.
It's now actually supporting genocide.
Okay, we could maybe just avoid that language if that's okay for now, because that is
And obviously, a U.S. vote of abstention on a Security Council resolution demanding a ceasefire would certainly be something that they would wish to ignore or minimize or sweep under the rug.
Among the other stories getting swept under, Israeli forces raiding hospitals in Gaza, such as Al-Shifa, producing horrific testimonies of the cold-blooded execution of Palestinians, including 13 children.
قالوا لنا عليكم الامانه بتطلع بتروح على الجنوب وقفنا صاروا يطقوا كلنا انبطحنا بعدين صاروا يتسلوا علينا واحد واحد بالقناص.
There was that aerial assassination of four young unarmed Gazans, Israeli drone footage obtained by Al Jazeera, and widespread allegations of the systemic sexual assault and humiliation of Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers, some of whom have also been accused of rape. American, and Western news outlets were all over such stories, many of which were later debunked when the accused were members of Hamas, the alleged victims were Israeli, and the date was October 7th.
The plausible genocide taking place in Gaza is unique in human history. Events on the ground are being transmitted in real time to the world as people are being killed and starved and so on. And that coverage that is coming from below is challenging the Western media coverage on these things.
The Western media, even subconsciously, is aware that it is feeding into the narrative of the demise of its own standing. Outside of a Western space, it's done. No one takes seriously Western claims to be standing up for international law. No one wants to hear it. After Gaza, the world will not be lectured to. There's no moral soapbox to stand on. It has dissolved away in the double standards and the naked transparency of the hypocrisy over Gaza. That leaves us with a real problem. We do not have a space that we can go to.
Last year, Amnesty International revealed that Israel was using facial recognition systems in the West Bank to entrench its occupation of Palestinians there. New details have now emerged about the technology that Israeli soldiers are using in Gaza. And Tarek Nafa is here with more.
Well, for months now, we've heard reports and seen videos of Palestinians forced from their homes, crossing checkpoints, where they are scanned by Israeli cameras. Some of these videos are truly dystopian. In addition to being watched, Palestinians are also harassed by Israeli forces. This week, a New York Times piece revealed more information about the mass surveillance Israel has deployed on Palestinians in Gaza. According to Israeli intelligence officials who spoke to the Times anonymously, it's part of an expansive and experimental effort to collect and catalogue the faces of Palestinians without their knowledge or consent. Developed by a private Israeli company called Corsite, Israeli officials say the system was initially used to search for Israeli captives in Gaza, but has since been used on a much wider scale to hunt down Hamas suspects. One of the problems with this kind of technology, as one Israeli officer confirms, is that it routinely gets it wrong. With Israeli soldiers accused of abusing, torturing, and executing Palestinians in Gaza, the consequences of being incorrectly identified as a Hamas fighter can cost you your life. The Israeli military has always used Gaza as a lab in which it can test and develop new ways of killing or spying on Palestinians. Artificial intelligence is reportedly being used to generate targets in Gaza, facilitating what one former intelligence officer has called a mass assassination factory. We've also seen several videos of Israeli drones shooting at and killing unarmed Palestinians. All of this technology has turned Gaza into a hellscape in which at least 32,500 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces.
Thank you, Tarek. In just under 3 weeks' time, on April 19th, India will begin a six-week-long election process for its next national government. It will all culminate on June 1st, and Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to win an historic third term in office. Modi's popularity ratings are high. Many of his opponents are mired in corruption cases filed by Modi's government. And then there's the news media. Mainstream outlets in India have been almost entirely captured by Modi's party, the BJP, churning out coverage that ranges from the sycophantic to the openly pro-government. And that servile media landscape may not be the most powerful weapon in the BJP's arsenal. It also has a formidable get-out-the-vote machine that combines an extensive volunteer network with the power of WhatsApp to influence voters, spread propaganda, and at times sow disinformation. The Listening Post's Meenakshi Ravi now on the all-encompassing information ecosystem that is likely to help put Narendra Modi back in the Prime Minister's office in New Delhi.
Americans have grown used to the omnipresence of their prime minister. He's on billboards, he's in the papers, both in ads and in the news. TV channels seem to have little else to cover. And on March 16th, the very day the dates for India's elections were announced, Narendra Modi was WhatsApping the country. A letter from the Prime Minister was delivered straight into the phones of hundreds of millions of Indians.
Mere pyare parivarjan, the transformation that has taken place in the lives of people is the biggest achievement of our government over the last 10 years. It is your support that gives me immense strength. I am confident that we will continue to take our nation to great heights together.
It was unvarnished electioneering by the ruling party, using the resources and access to phone number databases of the government. And it was unsurprising, it was all happening on WhatsApp.
Technology is very much part of the arsenal which the BJP of Prime Minister Narendra Modi uses. The BJP understood before any other party, every Indian may not have literacy and public health and so on and so forth, but they have their cell phones. India has the cheapest data in the world. So the BJP, in areas where it wishes to contest seriously, it develops messaging for each constituency. That was something that Prime Minister Modi and the Bharatiya Janata Party understood very well.
Mr. Amit Shah, who is actually virtually the number two to Mr. Modi within the BJP, few years ago, while speaking to party workers, he had actually boasted, you know, it is very easy for us to take the message because we have the largest WhatsApp network in the country.
WhatsApp एक 8 बजे को भेज देते थे सत्य जानेंगे अखबार को कुछ भी भाजपा के लिए गलत प्रकार की खबरें भेजता था उनकी सच्चाई वो WhatsApp पर डालते और WhatsApp पर वो वायरल हो जाती थी.
Now that was not a boast, that is actually true. You actually have a centralized cell within the BJP which actually in the morning it decides, okay, these are today's messages which are to be publicized. And they're kind of broadcast to various parts of the country.
The BJP's messaging is carefully tailored and highly produced, with the party's star campaigner front and center in virtually all of it. The Modi motorcade drives through throngs of cheering Indians. The videos from that make it to WhatsApp groups, YouTube shorts, and Instagram reels. The Prime Minister hangs out with kids in schools and presents 20-something social media influencers with awards from the government. He prays at multiple temples with cameras in tow, even if the holy site is underwater. Those clips don't just stay on social media, they make the evening news bulletins.
Look closely on his screens. He even decided to go underwater to pray at the submerged Dwarka.
All this is part of media strategy, creating a nationwide perception that Narendra Modi, as the leader of this ruling party, wants to take India forward, wants to create a developed India and make it the third largest economy in the world.
And this is not anything now. Now it's going to go further.
One senior leader of the BJP had said about Mr. Modi, he said, for Narendra Modi, elections is a battle of images. And that is what the Indian Prime Minister has shown himself to be very good at. And you can agree with his ideology, his policies, or disagree. But it is his skills at political marketing that have been noticed.
We must remember that in India, democracy works in different language zones. So the question is, how do you recognize a party?
Modi Sarkar.
Electoral symbols are important. In the case of Prime Minister Modi, it is the recognition value of the Modi name, the Modi face. He has different personas that he has presented to the public. One is that of a term called Vishwa Guru, which means world leader. His performance on the international stage is constantly projected back home. The other aspect of the messaging is that of being a strong, unapologetic Hindu who goes and leads ceremonies in temples. almost performs like a head priest. Some of his party people have likened him to a godlike figure. The messaging is extremely comprehensive, which is, according to data, the most expensive in India's history.
The BJP's finances are formidable. The party is the wealthiest in India. Its funds boosted by a financial tool it launched in 2017 called an electoral bond. This powerful instrument ushered in a wave of political donations to numerous parties across India. The bulk of the money, however, nearly 60%, went to the BJP, amounting to about 60 billion rupees, more than $725 million, earned between 2017 and just 2 months ago, February 2024, when the Supreme Court declared electoral bonds illegal due to their lack of transparency. The money is in the BJP's coffers, though, and it powers not just an incessant stream of PR, but also an impressive organizational behemoth that underpins the party's election strategy.
On paper, today the BJP is the largest political party in the world. It is larger than the Communist Party of China.
Bharat Mata Ki!
So there is a huge network of party volunteers who are spread across the country. Besides that, it's very important to understand that the BJP is not a standalone organization, but it is part of a fairly large ideological umbrella group, the Sangh Parivar. It's an organization which was formed in 1925, almost 100 years ago. And everywhere they have a presence. So during elections, it is not just the BJP which is out campaigning, but you have leaders and cadre which fan out to virtually every village and every electoral booth in the country.
So I think the door-to-door campaigning is a very effective method. You know, each page of the electoral rolls is assigned to one person. So that person goes, you know, to the visits the families to try and to find out have they benefited from the policies and the programs of the party. If not, why not? It is a party that's driven with a will to power, and therefore every tool becomes very important for them. Now, that the problem with the opposition is they don't have that kind of a will.
The opposition's problems extend far beyond a supposed shortage of will. Over the past decade, India's numerous non-BJP or non-BJP allied parties have come under serious pressure. Corruption has been a powerful line of attack from the Modi government. It has enabled a relentless hounding of opposition leaders on a range of cases, some credible, others less so.
Itne ghotale kiye hain ke apne aap mein corruption Olympic ka khel ayojit ho jaye.
The result has been numerous politicians in jail, a deep reputational hit for opposition parties, and a strong incentive for those not keen to see the inside of a prison cell to simply switch sides to the BJP and breathe a sigh of relief.
The other query we must ask is, the playing field now a level playing field for the BJP and the opposition? And we must, as journalists, it's our job to flag that. Yet, for all the many problems that the opposition faces, they are going to put up candidates and fight the BJP. But the BJP is working on a very, very simple tack, that they, part of the messaging right now is to say there is no alternative to us. That is all part of the hype, Modi versus whom, you know, that Modi is the only answer to India.
Back to Israel, Gaza, the U.S., and the UN. This past week, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francesca Albanese, published an extensive report. The title, Anatomy of a Genocide, which the Netanyahu government says it utterly rejects. So apparently does the U.S. State Department. Its chief spokesman, Matthew Miller, said of Albanese, I can't help but note a history of anti-Semitic comments that she has made. Miller needs to do some research. The Israeli government has been accusing Albanese of anti-Semitism for years now, conflating her legitimate criticism of an illegal occupation for a form of hatred. And in late 2022, 65 scholars, All experts on anti-Semitism endorsed Albanese's work, saying that Israel's supporters are simply out to silence her. Some online voices have described Matthew Miller's comments as a new low for the Biden administration. But it's not like we haven't heard that before. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.